Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. It's so nice to spend time with Alderville Chief Tainar Simpson. How are you today, Chief?
I'm doing really well, despite the weather, having hail and cold, and just not ready for this kind of weather to keep on going.
Well, we're lucky enough to be indoors and going to have a lovely conversation today.
That's right.
A CBC Indigenous investigation dating back to the 1960s found that the RCMP did extensive surveillance against First Nations, Inuit, and Métis leaders and organizations. Was this something you were aware of prior to this recent release of this information?
I wasn't aware of the exact specifics, but I was aware that Canadian authorities had undertaken exercises to potentially address what they saw as Native extremism. When I was working for the Department of National Defense at the National Defense Headquarters in the 1990s, I came across some exercises that were basically Canadian forces entering reserves and trying to, I guess, take out, for lack of a better word, the what they called Indigenous extremists.
What went through your mind when you saw that?
Well, I realized how far we still had to go in our relations with the Crown. So I knew that seeing that, it meant that the Crown didn't really see us as full citizens. They didn't see us as partners. They saw us more as something to be concerned about and potentially have to control or eventually even maybe put a stop to.
Was there ever any examples of Indigenous extremism? It's a large population. Were there ever anybody that seemed to be going over the top?
Not that I can think of. I know in the States with AIM, I wouldn't quite call it extremism, but they did take over Alcatraz where they were broadcasting for that one summer. So I don't think that in Canada we quite rose to that level of social disorder. But at the same time, I think at that time in the 60s, that was an awakening for our people. It was the civil rights movement. And we were finally realizing our place in Canada wasn't necessarily the place that Canada wanted us to be. So we were trying to redefine what our role is based on the treaties and the history that we had to that point.
For listeners who may not know what AIM is, could you tell us what that is?
Yes, it's it stands for the American Indian Movement, and it rose about because of the specific history experience between the First Nations in the States and the government of the United States down there. So they took a more active approach, and Leonard Peltier, who was just released last year from prison, where he was pretty much for my entire life, that was one of the biggest cases of the AIM movement.
Is there anything that might be similar in Canada? We hear of things like Idle No More and other movements. Is there something similar?
Well, I guess we had OCA, the OCA crisis, which was a seminal point in our history, where the Mohawks in Quebec decided that they were no longer going to just take whatever developments were happening on their territory without their say, without their consent. So they put up a blockade, basically, and we know how that ended. It ended in the deaths of two people, as well as it changed the dynamic between First Nations and the Crown after that.
Has there been any cases locally where there's been a sense that there's been surveillance?
Not that I'm aware of, because I think if I was aware of it, I'd be making a big issue out of it. I'm sure that most of those examples of what the program entailed hasn't been released yet. We will be keeping an eye towards any information and documents that that come out, maybe either through an access to information and privacy ruling or by more media inquiries, or perhaps the government will just come clean. I know Mark Carney said he is going to be issuing an apology. And so with an apology, you would think would come full disclosure.
Well, let's talk a bit about that because there was a strong backlash from Indigenous leaders regarding this recent CBC story calling for an apology. What does an apology do to mitigate what has happened in your mind?
I think the apology has many facets. So it acknowledges a wrongdoing. It acknowledges the fact that things should have happened differently. It potentially opens the door to compensation for those who were surveilled in the 60s and 70s, and rightfully so. And it means that they're going to not do it again in the future, or at least that's the idea and the intent that they would no longer be surveilling in this manner.
Prime Minister Mark Carney said there should be a public apology for spying operations targeting Indigenous people. Does that make any difference that he said this?
I would say that it does. The fact that it was almost immediate shows that he is committed to correcting past wrongs. And we've heard him say this in the past. And of course, we're always skeptical when we hear a prime minister say that they're going to do things differently. But the fact that he issued a statement saying that they are looking forward to apologizing very quickly after the article came out, I think he is probably going to issue that apology, and we're going to be looking forward to that when it comes.
He also said, though, in his statement, that this was reprehensive and should have never happened. How does that sit with you, that kind of remorse?
I totally understand it. I think as politicians in Canada, they might not be fully aware of the extreme lengths that the Crown went to subvert and to basically assimilate and try to keep First Nations people down in this country. I know people say that, oh, that's not what happened, or that was so long ago, get over it. That's not the case. I mean, we are still here. We're still basically governed by the Indian Act, which is a paternalistic system that keeps us as wards of the state. So I think people need to understand that this is our full history. So when you have politicians coming in who don't understand that full history, oftentimes they will act shocked or surprised that this kind of thing happened.
There are others who are being asked to apologize, including the Federal Public Safety Minister and the Commissioner of the RCMP. The RCMP Commissioner has issued a statement expressing regret and pledged to meet with Indigenous leaders and elders. So far, the Prime Minister, then the Federal Public Safety Minister, and the RCMP have all released public statements of regret. From what I understand, there is no word if a public apology is coming from a government. In other words, there has been no date set or, any timeline for that, and only a promise to meet with the RCMP. And again, no date has been set. How do you react to what has unfolded so far in terms of the overall response, given that this story broke nearly a month ago?
My first impression would be that they're trying to get all of their ducks in a row. You have two of those people who are politicians, elected politicians, and you have that third party, which was the authority, the police, if you will, who were surveilling. So they would need to get together to realize probably the extent of the liability. They'd want to have a good handle on what happened and what the repercussions are going to be before they would come forward, because they know that as soon as they do that apology, there are going to be those people who are affected looking for further actions about that apology.
So the timelines don't worry you.
These things take time. I understand that. I mean, obviously, they never happen as quick as you would like them to. I think Mark Carney's a smart individual, and he is going to be making sure, basically, that everything's been covered before he issues that apology. I would be very concerned if the apology doesn't come out in the next month or two, and then that would probably mean that the scandal or the whatever happened in the 60s and 70s is far worse than he initially thought.
The NDP have called for public hearings on this. How do you feel about that?
I absolutely agree that that should happen. We're seeing this more and more where there were secret programs about First Nations. We had those secret medical experiments that were happening on us. We had the residential school system, which was one big secret. So this is just the latest secret to come out that what the Crown was trying to do to Indigenous people in Canada. So I know that this probably isn't the last. We're going to be finding out these things happened for decades to come now.
There are some within the Indigenous community who suggest the data collected could have contributed to the over-incarceration of Indigenous people. Do you believe that's true?
I would say it's more of a symptom of how enforcement authorities perceived Indigenous people in general. So the fact that they thought they needed to do this surveillance program is also the same reason why we are incarcerated. So I wouldn't say the surveillance program caused it. I would say that the fundamental view of Canadian law enforcement on Indigenous people, which hasn't changed in the past, is what caused both of these things to happen.
The Yellowhead Institute, an Indigenous-led research and education center based at the Faculty of Arts at the Toronto Metropolitan University, says this kind of spying was going on even before the 1960s. Do you believe that, and do you have any idea if that is true?
Oh, 100%. It's true. This would have been happening since probably the 1800s, and perhaps even before. The Crown, before Canada was even a country, took great efforts to try to understand First Nations people. They wanted to bring them to the table, and they also wanted information about how we were operating without just basically asking us. So I think that some level of this information gathering, however you want to call it, has been ongoing since probably contact.
What is the reaction of the Alderville community to these stories? Have you heard anything from your residents?
Like all things that happen like this, there is that anger, but it's not surprise. We aren't surprised about these things anymore. We're just probably assumed that there was a program like this, and now we know it happened. So I think it's good that we know that it happened. We are optimistic they're going to get to the bottom of it, and all the information is going to come out. So again, anger is a very natural reaction to these things, but I think we're just so tired of being angry about all the crazy things that the Crown has done to First Nations in Canada. You get that anger fatigue after a while, or some people just stay angry their whole life, which you see a lot of the times, but that anger doesn't solve the problem. That anger won't get to the bottom of these issues and push us towards reconciliation.
What structural changes need to take place then?
Well, I think you'd need to go right down to what we consider the security apparatus in Canada. There needs to be some eye to eye from the First Nations community and that law enforcement community about what exactly they feel the threat is. What are they afraid of? What's the concern that they have that they felt they had to take these extraordinary steps? And I think getting that dialogue going is going to be key to ensuring something like this doesn't happen again.
I'd like to change topics now for just a moment and talk about an update on the Ontario First Nations Child and Family Services settlement. Late in March, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal issued a decision approving a final agreement to reform the First Nations Child and Family Services program in Ontario. It was for $8.5 billion. What was your reaction when you heard this news?
Well, it's something we saw coming. We were not sure 100% how the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal was going to deem this case. They did deem it in Ontario, Anishinaabeyaskis and Chiefs of Ontario's favor, that the agreement did meet the needs of what the original intent was. For those that don't know, there was a national agreement that was reached a couple of years ago, but that was rejected by the AFN Chiefs in Assembly. But Ontario decided to go its own route, so we were able to successfully negotiate an agreement that, for the most part, was acceptable to all but two First Nations in Ontario.
Why is this significant?
It's significant because not only does it recognize a past wrong, a past underfunding of Indigenous children in Canada, where they weren't funded to the same level that non-Indigenous children were. So not only does it recognize that, but it provides the funds to ensure that that doesn't happen again. It provides the funds to ensure that we have those capacities that the other children in care in Canada are accustomed to.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, you mentioned it, the October 2024 agreement where the Assembly of First Nations rejected the proposal for, I believe it was for $47.8 billion over 10 years. Why is this decision significant in the context of the fact that the Assembly of First Nations has rejected this and so many other First Nations have not reached an agreement like the ones in Ontario?
Well, I think there were some differences at the leadership level, especially in terms of what the Caring Society was ultimately hoping for. I know that they wanted more in that agreement. And of course, you always do want to push that envelope. So they were able to basically have the AFN Chiefs and Assembly decide that this agreement didn't go far enough. But here in Ontario, the Chiefs were more on board with the agreement because we wanted to see action happening right now for our children. We wanted to basically correct those issues today and not at some point in the future. So we said we are going to pursue our own Ontario-only agreement with the Crown.
Is there anything different between the previous rejected agreement and the current one that was approved?
I think that there is. So it's generally the agreement's terms are the same, but they did look at some of the specific concerns that were raised by First Nations in Ontario. So they tried to address those as best as possible. Two First Nations decided that they did not want to participate in this agreement. So the Crown agreed to further meet with them to allay their concerns and try to meet their needs as best as possible.
That certainly is a good overview. Is there anything specific that you can tell us that might be different in terms of individual or details?
Well, I think in general, no, it's pretty much the same agreement because what we agreed to on the national level is what we said that Ontario wants. So we tried not to change it much from that original national agreement just because it had already been agreed to. So we thought that what we're setting here is going to hopefully be an example for the rest of the provinces. But we did try to make those tweaks to help those other First Nations that weren't entirely convinced with the agreement.
Now that this has been approved, how will it impact child and family services in Alderville?
Well, I think we're going to see more consistent funding. Oftentimes, we don't get the same level of funding on a year-to-year basis. Recently, it has been better than in the past, just because all the attention to this issue with Jordan's principal, with the realizing that we are constantly underfunded compared to the rest of the nation. So I think we're going to see some immediate help in terms of post-majority, which is post-majority is children in care that reach the age of majority, 18, and then basically the system just drops them. So, but these are still children in a lot of ways that need those helps and supports. So we're going to be seeing a lot more care for these individuals and support for these individuals, as well as prevention support. So not even having to get to the point of bringing in child aid services. So we'd want to cut a lot of those issues off at the pass, and this agreement will provide funds for that prevention.
For listeners who may not recall, what is Jordan's principle?
Jordan's principle came about where there was a sick little child, Jordan, who was in he basically wasn't receiving the care and attention that he needed, something that other children in his situation who were non-Indigenous did get care. And he unfortunately did pass away when perhaps he wouldn't have had to had those systems been in place that fully supported him as they do the rest of the country. So we said no more at that point. And then there was a big, I guess, push to recognize children who weren't receiving the same level of care and support as the rest of Canada. So what happened with Jordan's principal was the Crown said, okay, we're no longer going to accept that. We are going to bring up the standard for First Nations to the national standard.
I'd like to go back a little bit and talk more in terms of the follow-up and how it's going to impact locally. Do you see any opportunities for new programs that will come out of this?
I think so. This is a time to really put our thinking cap on. It's an opportunity that doesn't happen too often. We've always had our wish list, and then you have to decide which of those things are the priority, which what can we actually afford to do, and then all those other things that we think are good ideas that there just hasn't been an ability to go. I think now we can look back and say, these were great ideas we had in the past. How can we go ahead and start implementing them?
Can you give us a couple examples of what's on that wish list?
Well, here in Alderville specifically, we were hoping to create some sort of a smaller community where we have maybe tiny homes. So people who live that are more vulnerable have a chance of falling into the child welfare system or perhaps are already there. Having a community with these built-in supports where they have a guaranteed place to live, and they might be able to get access to services like resume writing so that they can apply for jobs. So just to provide that safe community space for these vulnerable families, maybe post-majority people to be able to get that step up. So this is something you'd really like to see in Alderville, homing these people that might not have a safe place to stay and giving them that chance to succeed in life.
Do you have any idea the number of children, young people, or families that will be impacted by all of this?
Across the province, it's hard to say, but we're definitely looking at thousands, if not tens of thousands, because every family affected isn't just one child. Sometimes it's multiple children. It's the entire family. It's all of the caregivers and extended family. So child well-being affects so many people and not just the children that are specifically in care. So I think we really don't have a good handle on that exact number. We know how many children are in care, but we don't know how many people beyond that would be affected by this.
You mentioned Ontario. I was thinking more in terms of Alderville.
In Alderville, we do have a number of families that have been touched by the child welfare system. I don't want to get into exact numbers, but it's larger than we would like. Plus, we have a large off-reserve population that would be involved in different child aid services across the country, really. So we want to ensure that we have a handle on that, that we're in contact with them, and that we're going to be providing them Indigenous lensed services if possible, and if they're open to that. So across the board, we do have a number of families.
Why are you reticent to give a number?
Well, first of all, I don't have the exact number on me. So if I did pull a number out, it might be more pulling it out of a hat. But I do know a number of individual cases that there's a number of privacy issues that, you know, we really don't want to make that big jump into. So sorry, that's a roundabout answer, I know.
How much money will Alderville receive over the 9-year period of this agreement?
We are not sure. It's not a matter of taking that big number and dividing it by the 130 plus First Nations that are in Ontario. It would be probably a lot of per capita. There's extra for remoteness of communities because of those increased remote costs. So we're not really sure. We want to be able to operate in a way that we feel we're meeting all of the needs of our children in care and vulnerable families, and whatever that costs is hopefully what we're going to receive. We don't want to receive more than we need, but we want to receive enough to be able to cover what we feel is necessary.
I'd like to move on now and talk about the Indian Act, which is about to turn 150 years old. So on April 5th, 1876, the federal government approved the Indian Act as a core document guiding First Nation government relations. Can you put this legislation into context for listeners as to its impact on Indigenous people over this century and a half?
Well, that it's you can't understate the impact that the Indian Act has had on First Nations people. It effectively created a First Nations population, a segment of the Canadian population that was a ward of the state, which effectively means we were children and we were treated as such. We weren't seen as people that had the capacity to look after ourselves. Really, the onus of the Indian Act was to walk back the intent and spirit of the treaties that were being signed at the time, where it recognized that Indigenous people had ownership of the land and that Indigenous people had come to an agreement that they decided they were going to share the land with the settlers, and this was a true sharing, not land surrenders and land seizures that the Crown was trying to portray it as. We agreed that we were going to let settlers move in and live on our lands. So the Crown at the time didn't like that because it didn't really recognize ownership for them over the lands. So by declaring us wards of the state, you were able to take possession of what those wards had, that being land and resources. So the Indian Act was really a way to seize the broader lands of what became Canada.
Besides the issue of land seizure, what have been some of the key features of the Act that should be highlighted for people to understand?
Okay, so what some of the language in the treaties said that there was land reserved solely for First Nations, whereas the rest of the land was going to be shared. We had reserves that were just for us. And what the Indian Act did was they spun that to say, all First Nations have to live on the reserve and they cannot leave it unless granted specific permission. So this is where the pass system came into play. So if you were put onto the reserve, you were not allowed to leave it unless the Indian agent gave you a pass for a specific time to leave and for a specific reason. And if you were not back by the time you said you were going to be, you would be off to jail. So this was a way to take us off of our lands, take us away from where we were living and basically going out during the different times of the year, either for fishing or harvesting. That route, that cycle that we would do on an annual basis ceased to exist because we were put on the reserves and not allowed to move along our lands anymore.
Is there anything in the Act that is redeemable or worthwhile in your mind?
Goodness, whatever is good in there probably is so negligible that I wouldn't want to give any credence to it, because the Indian Act is something that needs to be replaced. It needs to be repealed, and the spirit and intent of the treaties need to be installed as how reconciliation, the First Nations people and the Crown live together going forward. So we do need to get rid of that Indian Act, but not in the way that Pierre Trudeau suggested in the 60s, which was the white paper, which was just to throw the Indian Act away and say, all Indigenous people are now white people. They're just full Canadians and there is no differences. So in some regard, the Indian Act acknowledged that we were different, acknowledged that we had lands, and acknowledged that there were some rights that couldn't even be removed by the Indian Act. The Indian Act still had to recognize that we did have these rights, but they were designed in a way that tried to buffer them from real action and real meaning.
Well, in those efforts, let's talk about some of the more recent initiatives that have tried to bring about change. You and I have talked recently about the Senate's amendments to significantly change the status of some First Nation members. Can you remind us briefly about the specific concerns that were raised?
Yes. So Bill S2, which is now approaching its final readings in the House of Commons, if it passes and receives royal assent unchanged from its current form, this will end the second generation cutoff rule for First Nation status. Again, status being something that the Indian Act created, which means that any First Nation parent can pass on their status to their child, which currently is not the case. So this will mean that reserves are not going to disappear. We've crunched the numbers, and within a few decades, the First Nations are going to start to disappear because no more status Indians are going to be born on those reserves. So that means that the Crown can seize all the lands on the reserve and make it part of what they think that, you know, Crown lands are supposed to be. So this would stop that from happening. It would also recognize that a lot of our community members who don't have status are actually entitled to status. So it will affect who we have in our community who can vote for leadership. So we would see a rise in our numbers and all people who can hold land within the reserve. So people who had to leave the reserve because they weren't status, they weren't allowed to own land on the reserve, they can now come back and have land and have a place in our communities.
There are various levels of self-governance across First Nations. Can you share some of those various agreements and to what level Indigenous people or First Nations have self-governing abilities?
Yes, so this is one of those things that the governments of the Crown a few decades ago moved away from that cookie cutter approach. So you had various nations signing what we know as self-government agreements, also known as comprehensive land claims, where they negotiated over sometimes decades to get a recognition of their lands, their treaty rights, as well as their political structure. So you'll see that a lot in out west in British Columbia, where they didn't sign those historic treaties. So they signed these modern day treaties that gave them more access to their lands and their resources, and basically gave them that solid base to build a nation from. So out here in the east, where we had these treaties going on for quite some time, and what the Crown considered to be land surrenders or purchases of land, these were things that changes how it is over here. So then we go back and look at how the original treaties, like with us, the Williams Treaty, how that came about and how those stipulations within that treaty were negotiated and how they weren't ever actually implemented properly. So then you get that settlement agreement that we had, which reinforced the original intent that we had had at the time of the negotiations. So every single First Nation or group or treaty area has these unique situations that you can't really just apply across the board. So you have different groups with different agreements with the Crown, and they all need to be dealt with separately and on their own merits.
Can you give us an example from Alderville about self-governance?
Well, the fact that we never gave up our right to self-govern ourselves. So as much as the Crown wrote legislation and wrote bills and laws and rules saying that we no longer were self-governing, we never accepted that. You can't have an outside nation just deciding that you are no longer sovereign. We fully reject that. We never gave up our sovereignty. We never gave up our lands. We agreed to share our lands, but we never gave any of that up. So just because an outside body doesn't recognize that doesn't mean it's not true. So we feel we have always been sovereign, and we've obviously not experienced sovereignty the way that we feel we should because of the force of the state on us. So this is something that, you know, this is reconciliation. This is something that people need to come to realize how this happened. We weren't defeated in war. We didn't sell our land for peanuts, and now it's our mistake. Oh, that's bad. This needs to be recognized that this is what's happened in Canada, and this is how we came to be where we are, and that the fundamental understanding that the Crown has about what they think Canada is wrong. And we need to have that reconciliation. We need to have that big national conversation about what does that mean for the future of Canada.
Can you give some specific examples of things that you do now that would exemplify how you are self-governing?
Well, let's go to, say, harvesting rights. So when we negotiated the Williams Treaties in 1923, we insisted that we wanted to be able to harvest from our land as we always had. That's fishing and that's hunting, gathering, collecting mushrooms, or whatever you want to say harvesting was. So now, when the after the treaty was signed, we were denied all of those rights. We weren't allowed to go out. We weren't allowed to hunt. We weren't allowed to fish. Our people were chased down. They were thrown in jail for doing what we thought we had agreed to being able to do. So when the Williams Treaty Settlement Agreement came out, it recognized those wrongs that some of our elders, because at that point it was the elders who had experienced the most pressure from the authorities and the most incarceration. So we wanted to ensure that they got their proper compensation for basically a lifetime of denied rights that they should have had.
I was thinking more in terms of the fact that you harvest rice out of Rice Lake would be might be an example. Would that be true of self-governance?
It would be because the rice is what makes the lake. The rice is why we kept coming back to Rice Lake and making it one of our primary homes. It was our staple. It was a food you could harvest, and it would last for years if kept in a dry, cool place. So this was our staple of food, the same way the buffalo were on the plains out west. So by removing the buffalo, by removing the rice, that effectively took away our way of life and our ability to sustain ourselves. So by seeing the rice come back, by being able to protect that rice and not have it be destroyed, that is self-government. That is that's us bringing back our sustainability, our viability, and our food sovereignty.
What is the future of the Indian Act in your mind?
Well, this is something that I've thought about lots over my lifetime. There needs to be some type of national reckoning, some national summit where all of the leaders, all of the chiefs, all of the governments come together. We sit down, we have the goal of saying we are going to get rid of the Indian Act. And what is that going to look like? And this isn't something that you can decide in a week or two. This is going to take years. But what does the reconstruction of the Canadian fabric look like? Because it's not working right now. It's not correct. It does need fixing. So, what that looks like, it's hard to say. There could be a few different ways to go about it. But I hope that in my lifetime, I can see that happen or even be a part of it. But I do believe that that conversation should start sooner than later because we know it has to happen. It'd be great if we could start that tomorrow.
Do you have any public service announcements for us this time?
I do. I'm happy to announce some of our happenings. So, at the Little NHL this past month, our under 18 team made it to the a B championship final game. And this was the first team Alderville was able to put together in 28 years because we never had enough kids to make up a team. So, most of our youth would join other First Nations teams. So, this was the first time in 28 years we had a team and they made it to the B championship game. So, I just want to give a big shout out to all of our little NHLers. You made us proud. On April 23rd, we have Alderville First Nation Culture Night. And this is something that is open to all members. If you want to be there, it's 5 to 7. Please contact Aiden and Jess to sign up. A little bit ahead of the time, on June 6th, we're having our wellness and artisan community event, and that's 10 to 3. So we're going to have holistic practitioners, herbal remedies, and other healing practitioners. So if you're interested in learning different ways from regular healthcare, please come out on June 6th. I also want to announce that we are redoing, hosting once again our tick submission program. So if you have found a tick on yourself or on your dog or other pet, if you're able to extract it and put it in some sort of a container, you can bring it by the Health and Social Services office for testing of Lyme disease or other diseases that you may think that they have. May 30th to May 31st, I want to announce that we are also having another ATV rider course. So if you are looking to safely operate your ATV, please contact the Child and Family Wellbeing Office to sign up. And I also want to give a shout out, a thank you to Brian Charles, who on April 8th hosted a Wampum Belt treaty history session at the Hilltop Wellness Center, where he explained the history of treaties through wampum belts. And even though I thought I knew a lot already, I learned so much from Brian Charles. So I want to send him out a big shi-migwech. Thank you. And that concludes my announcements.
I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. Please take care, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation, Chief.
Me too. Thank you.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.